Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. My name is John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. In this reboot of the Short Story Today podcast, the authors we celebrate will be living authors, and we'll get to ask them questions about what makes them tick so we can learn about the experience of writing from experienced people. I am so thrilled to be speaking from this auspicious juncture in the life of the Short Story Today podcast. There have been times when the anticipation has been almost too much to bear, and yet we've managed to keep the ship on course. And here we are. There are many things to discuss in this episode, so it's going to be a bit longer than normal, but that's okay. It's a special occasion. I want to start out by thanking a couple of artists who have agreed to let me borrow some of their creativity for the podcast. I'm seeing that there is room for all kinds of creativity to be celebrated here and on the podcast's media sites. I've had amazing good luck in finding all of the people who are participating in this podcast project. That great piece of music you heard at the opening is by the multi-talented artist C.S. Fuqua, otherwise known as Chris. He's not only a musician and composer, but he's a gifted writer as well. The song is titled Bad Joke, which I hope we can look at as an ironic commentary and not as an assessment of the podcast, but really it's just the title of the song. At the end of the podcast, I'll provide information about where you can find Chris's music and download it for purchase. The other musician I'd like to thank is Matt Hawkins, who lives in Brisbane in Queensland, Australia, and his song Bridge of Stories will carry us out at the end of the podcast. So thank you, Chris and Matt, for your generosity and your magnificent gifts of creativity. We're going to start out the podcast today with an interview with our first guest on this first episode of Short Story Today, John Henry Fleming. John is the author of the novel The Legend of the Barefoot Mailman, Fearsome Creatures of Florida, a Literary Bestiary, and the book I Will Write, a serial novel in emails. His short stories have appeared in journals such as McSweeney's, The North American Review, Mississippi Review, 14 Hills, and Carve, and have been anthologized in 100% Pure Florida Fiction and in the Future Dictionary of America. His awards include a literature fellowship from the state of Florida. He has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Louisiana, Lafayette. At the University of Southern Florida, he directs the creative writing program and is the founder and advisory editor of Saw Palm, Florida Literature and Art, a literary and art journal. The story I'll be reading today is from his anthology, Songs for the Deaf, published by Burrow Press. There's something I wanted to point out before we get into the interview part of the episode. We had a little bit of a technical snafu with the directional microphone. Turned out that the connection was bad. Luckily, the computer's microphone did pick up my audio, but it is a little substandard, not typically what you would hear on a professional recording, but it is tolerable. So with that said, here's my interview with John Henry Fleming.
I would like to welcome my very first guest on the very first episode of the Reimagined Short Story Today podcast, John Henry Fleming, who has been invaluable in his assistance. So I want to just start out by saying thank you, John.
Thanks, John. I appreciate that. And I'm honored to be the first guest. I'm excited about the new podcast, and I will be a fan.
Thank you. Thank you. And I feel very honored to have you here as my first guest, because you are not what I would consider an emerging author. That is a term that I use for want of anything better. But in your case, you have done some pretty significant things. You have the collection of short stories, Songs for the Deaf, published by a notable publishing house, Burrow Press. You're not the typical emergent artist here.
I feel like I'm always emerging. I don't know any writer who isn't racked with self-doubts. Part of it's, you know, the plight of a writer is to work in isolation for the most part. And so it's just you and the page or you and the screen. So you can go in the space of a day thinking you're a genius and thinking you're a complete moron.
Do you have days where you really just feel like you've squandered your day because the stuff you're coming up with just doesn't feel like it's working and you just can't use it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, either it's just I know it's bad, or I just can't get anything written or barely anything written. And then, you know, I've sat in front of the screen for several hours and either my productivity is low or the words that came out are just, I know they're not going to work. And so, I mean, in a way, you have to have some faith in the process. You have to know that you get something down, you're going to be able to go back and revise it and you'll make things better. But it's that painful part of just leaving things there on the screen or on a page that you know are terrible.
Yeah.
They exist in the world and you made them.
It has to get to you after a while to be, you know, alone in a room and just be there with yourself like that and all the things that come up in the day because of that.
I mean, it's great and also terrifying.
I
keep doing it, so I must I must love it.
Is there a time and place or anything specific about when that maybe had occurred to you where you thought, oh, you know what, I think I really can do this?
I think when I was in grad school, I was writing stories largely. And then one summer I began my first novel, and I sort of did it just to have fun because I felt the kind of weight of trying to write literary works that would get in high quality journals, literary magazines. And I'm just going to write something for fun. And then I remembered this from my fourth grade Florida history unit at Boynton Beach Elementary. We studied the Barefoot Mailman, which is a historical figure in 1880s into the 1890s in South Florida that delivered the mail from what's now West Palm Beach to what's now Miami, walking up and down the beach. And at the time I was in grad school in Louisiana, and I thought of that, I'm like, well, this is so strange, you know, and I had been out of Florida for a while, and I knew that Florida was a strange place, and somehow the Barefoot Mailman encapsulated something about the strangeness of Florida to me. So, and I think I had to be away from Florida in order to write that. So I started this longish story that became a novel. So in one summer, I had a kind of draft of this story. Like, I wonder if I could write a novel, you know, and I'm just gonna try this. And the longest story served as a treatment for the novel. So I just wrote 3 pages a day through the summer, you know, sweltering in Louisiana. And then by the end of the summer, I had, you know, I got to page 100. I'm like, wow, okay, I can make 100 pages. And then finished a draft of it. And at that point, I'm like, okay, I can write a novel. I don't know if I'll ever be able to sell it or anything, but I kept at it and then finally did sell it. So I guess it was that process of writing the first novel and then, of course, getting it sold that made me think that I could keep doing it.
And how old were you when you finished that first novel?
I was 29.
Wow. And had you written many short stories prior to writing the novel?
Yeah, I'd only published one or two at that point, short stories, but that I wrote the novel when I was doing a PhD in Louisiana, and I had done a master's thesis at Southern Mississippi. There was a collection of short stories, one of which did get published. So I'd been writing short stories all along.
So a lot of your life has been spent in the South, it sounds like.
Yes. I was born in Detroit. My family moved to Florida when I was about 9, and I went to college in Virginia, Mississippi, Louisiana, and I spent a good amount of time in the South. And yeah. Now I'm in Tampa, which is maybe slightly more Southern influenced than than most of South Florida, but it's still its own thing. It's Florida. I'm teaching at a university. I mean, that's the benefit of writers now. There are so many writing programs. So if you can get a gig at a university, you know, at least you have like a steady income and you're not scrambling for dollars and for survival.
It seems to be the ideal situation, but those jobs are not very easy to come by.
Very, very difficult to come by. Yeah. I mean, it's like every year MFA programs and PhD programs in creative writing keep cranking out graduates. And we have an MFA program too. And we try to get them to keep their eyes open about what their career prospects are and to look at things beyond teaching. Because they don't want to end up as an adjunct, you know, making $2,000 a course and teaching at 3 different colleges just to make ends meet for years at a time. So, and there's a lot of people like that who are having to go through that, unfortunately. So,
you and your students created this really incredible literary journal called the Saw Palm Review that I'd love for you to talk a little bit about.
So yeah, Saw Palm, we're about to come out with our 16th issue, annual issue, and it's got a Florida theme. You don't have to be a Florida writer, but your work should in some way address Florida, even if it's oblique. We wanted to give my day for the journal was to sort of counter the sort of Florida man view and the tourist brochure view. Right. Florida, you know, there's always a battle in Florida. There's the marketing of Florida, you know, starting with the Fountain of Youth. So every year this is produced as part of a class, a literary editing and publishing class that I or one of my colleagues teaches in the fall. And it's produced by the grad students in that class in the MFA program. So they're the ones responsible for evaluating the manuscripts and communicating with the writers and doing all the production work. And if all goes well, we come out in early spring of the following year. And we have artwork from Florida artists. We have poetry, nonfiction, and fiction. Sometimes we have interviews. We have the sawpalm.org website with additional interviews and reviews of Florida-related things. And we have another thing on the website called Places to Stand in Florida, which is a Google Earth map with push pins all over it. And you click on one of the push pins and up pops a little piece of nonfiction or a poem about what it's like to be in that particular place at a particular moment.
What a tremendous experience for those students to have. Just the idea that they are contributing to something of this quality and all of the different parts, moving parts, to be able to learn from the ground up how to do something like that.
It also, they say frequently, helps them with their own writing because they are used to being on the other side of that, submitting to magazines. And the process when you submit to magazines is pretty mysterious at first. You don't know who's reading it, how they're making decisions, and why they reject your work. A lot of times you get no notice at all, except just a form rejection from a story or a poem you've sent in saying, we just can't use your work this time. And it never feels good for any writer to receive that. But being on the other end, on the editorial staff, you get to see that there are a lot of stories that come close to being accepted, but for one reason or another are not. And that one reason or another may not have anything to do with the quality of the work. It may be just that we have published another story about an ostrich or a giraffe this issue or last issue, so we can't have that. Or it may be that the reader or readers were just not having a good day, and so it didn't work out. Or sometimes the issue is pretty well full and there's no room for anything else. So it really helps the students to be on that end of
things. Yeah.
And also when you're sifting through, you know, 100 submissions of short stories, say, you know, you start to notice right away what works and what doesn't.
Yes.
And you can start to tell in the first page or so, is this a story that's going to work? Is the writing compelling? Is there something on this first page to grab my attention, whether it's the good writing or an interesting character or an interesting setting or a plot development right on the first page, something to really pull you into the story. And if you're not feeling that right away, it often gets rejected. So knowing that as a writer makes you up your game quite a bit when you're about to submit to journals.
The school must be very proud of that achievement. I would imagine that's like a jewel in the crown of the University of Southern Florida.
Yeah, we've had some special issues. We had a couple issues ago. We had a Florida Noir issue. We had an issue on the Florida-Cuba connection. And then we had a special issue on Florida postcards.
I want to talk about your writing because we really haven't done much of that yet. And I want to start with Songs for the Deaf, because that's the thing I probably know best of your work.
On Songs for the Deaf, when that was published, I also published, I did it as a Facebook note. I kept the rejection and acceptance statistics for that. So I kept track of, for each story, where I had sent it, how many rejections I got. And I published that in large part to sort of encourage writers, you know, like we were talking before about how a rejection you should not take as a comment on the quality of your work all the time. There are opportunities for you to revise that when it gets rejected and make it better, but sometimes it's not the quality of the work that is the reason it got rejected. So
right.
part of that process for me of submitting to journals was like, yes, yeah, some of them got accepted fairly quickly. Some of them took years. I have at least one story in there that I think took 9 years to get accepted.
Wow.
I think that was a song for the deaf.
Really?
Title story. But what happened with it, and with a lot of stories there, is it would go out for a round of submissions to journals. And then when it got rejected, I would take another look at it, you know, with a colder, harsher eye. And like, okay, I can change this. I can make it better. This is probably too long. I need to shorten it up. And so it would keep, that process would continue over those years. Not constantly, you know, sometimes I maybe had given up sending it out for a while. And then I would, you know, a year later, I would look at it again. I'm like, okay, there's something here. I just haven't figured it out. Take another crack at it, send it out again. Eventually got it published. But that process of sending things out to literary journals is part of the writing process for me. Yes, right. You make it as good as you possibly can, send it out. And then when it doesn't get accepted, you take it back and you make it even better. You know, right. You find ways to make it better. So it sort of pushes me to write better and better, try new things with the stories until I can find a way to get them to work.
Right. And the notion that you could have had something rejected time after time and still see something in it and not give up on it.
Well, at some point, it's, you just realize, okay, well, this is what I've decided to do with my life. So not everything I write is going to be great, and not everything I write is going to be published, but the stuff that I enjoy, I feel like there's something there that other people can appreciate too. It motivates me to keep going back to them and figuring out what I need to do to make it better or good enough. And I think it's sticking with it is a big part of the process. There are a lot of really good writers out there who just, for whatever reason, don't have the stomach for all that rejection and the time it takes. But for the ones who can stick it out, keep working on it, put in their 10,000 hours or whatever it takes, you will start publishing. It's not likely you're going to make a career of just writing. Almost nobody does that.
Yeah.
But you can still publish. You can make that part of your life.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the kind of things that you write. You really kind of run the gamut in terms of style and form. When you're getting ideas for these things, do you just kind of work from a random thought or idea sometimes and think, oh, this could probably become something?
I don't really have a set approach, but a couple of things prompt stories. One is just like a weird scenario. Mix this element in with this element and let's see what happens, you know, like a mad scientist in his lab. The other one is settings, you know. Yes. I've done enough traveling around the country and around Florida that, you know, certain settings have an effect on me in memory. So I'll want to write a story that captures what I feel about that setting at that time in my life. And then, you know, I'm often drawn to the weird and the dark and the satirical. So they end up taking those shapes, but I try to capture something I feel about a place. So that's why a lot of the stories in Songs for the Deaf take place all around the country, really. There's a lot of weather in my stories. And So part of it is that, you know, like trying to capture, especially growing up in Florida, where, I mean, we don't have the four seasons that the northern states do, but what we have is like an intense summer, rainy season where every afternoon you'll get these incredible downpours and thunder showers. And then, you know, 2 hours later, it clears up. The storms, when I was a kid, stuck with me a lot. You know, I loved going out and like watching the storms. And, you know, my dad was big into that too. We would sit in the garage in both in Michigan and Florida, set up lounge chairs and with a garage door open and stare out at the rain and the lightning and, you know, count the difference between the lightning flash and the thunder peal, see how far away it was. And then, of course, hurricanes in Florida, you know, that, you know, mapping out, okay, here's the hurricane in the Caribbean, you know, what are the chances it's going to hit here? And I used to, you know, have my own little hurricane map and I would plot it out on there, you know, just I really wanted the hurricanes to come and hit us. I didn't know any better when I was a kid. Now I'd be like, you know, I'd like to see the storm, but I don't want the damage.
The light shows are cool, but the rest of it really is not that great.
Right. Of course, now as a homeowner, I would have to pay for the damage. So I don't want that either. For a story like Cloud Reader, you know, just imagining the shapes of clouds in Florida that I see all the time and the thunderheads that build up. And of course, I've been through the plains too and seen what the clouds look like there. And on the plains where you can see so much of the sky and so much of the clouds, that really affected me. And I wanted to write something about that. So the idea that there was a kind of a prophet who formed his prophecies based on the shapes of clouds was a really interesting idea to me. And so I wanted to pursue that. A lot of my stories and novels are connected with the idea of trying to understand where a belief comes from and when a belief becomes a legend and a legend becomes a myth. And, you know, how do you turn a lie into the truth and that whole process, you know? So for an outsider coming into a community like the Cloud Reader is somebody whose sort of religion is understanding the clouds and telling people what he sees in the clouds. You know, he's a tea leaf reader,
right?
But with clouds. But he's coming into a community where there's an established religion. You know, he has this friction with the ministers in the towns that he comes to visit. So people want to believe the Cloud Reader when he has something good to say and not so much when he doesn't, but he's paid for it, you know. And then the preachers object to that, and he's a challenge to the existing religions. And then for him, part of the process for him, I think it goes into a bit of a flashback where he didn't understand what he was going to do with his life, and he would sit out and look at the clouds and try to understand them, see shapes in clouds as we all do, but then he turned it into something else. So he had to convince himself, he had to be the product of his own convictions about what he sees and what that could mean. And it's very much like the process of a writer goes through, I think, and that's probably why it strikes a chord for me is sort of as a writer, you have to convince yourself first that what you're writing is in some sense true, you know, if not literally true, but have some ring of truth that others can believe in, at least for the duration of the story. That old line about willing suspension of disbelief, you know, that whole process of trying to believe in what you are saying first of all, and then the next step making others believe in what you're are telling them. So a lot of my work is related to that. Like in the Legend of the Barefoot Mailman story, it's sort of a tall tale satire on the birth of the Florida tourist industry. So it's largely comic, but there's this huckster figure who's you know, in what's now West Palm Beach. He wants to attract rich Yankee tourists to his little restaurant in the middle of nowhere, basically. And so he falls on this story of this missing barefoot mailman to help create a legend and a mystery surrounding him that attracts people to his little town. So a lot of that story is about that process of, you know, how do you take this action of a barefoot mailman, turn it into a legend, and then turn that legend into some profit-making business for a character.
So tell us a little bit about your the novel that you're going to be taking a sabbatical in the fall to work on this novel, which you put a little teaser out on Twitter, which was, I believe it was the first page of the novel.
Yeah.
Which is a hell of a first page. I mean, that, talk about a hook. I retweeted it because I thought people have to see what someone can do on a, you know, with the first page of a novel to get your attention.
And well, that's been revised, you know, 50 times before that, because it helps me in the process to have at least one page where I can say, okay, this is what I want it to sound like.
Mm-hmm.
Give it some momentum, give me some things to keep writing about. So yeah, that's part of the reason I put it on Twitter. I'm like, okay, I've revised this enough. I need to like put it out, see what it feels like to put that out into the world. And yeah, it was good. It's a good experience. But so that novel is very, very loosely based on the Lewis and Clark expedition. Some details are still being worked out. I have a rough draft of it. I still have a lot more work to do. kind of starting the second draft, but still thinking of it as a first draft because I could go in some, I'm going to try out some things and go in different directions with it. But it's about this kid who sort of hijacks his way aboard the Lewis and Clark expedition. And he's kind of going out west in search of his mother. His mother is Native American and she ran away from home. His father's white. His father's abusive and he wants to go figure out why his mother left him and at least talk to her, see her again. But he has no idea where she went and he has no idea how big the West is. And so he just learns about Lewis and Clark heading west on the Missouri River and he wants to be a part of it. So he does get on board and he starts heading west. And part of the original premise for this novel was that at the time, if you read anything about Lewis and Clark expedition, the white and mixed race crew members on that expedition had no idea what they were going to find. And neither did Thomas Jefferson, you know, like for them, for the non-native people heading west, that was just a big blank slate in the middle of the country. They didn't know what they were going to find. And they legitimately thought that there might be woolly mammoths still living there, giant sloths still living there. They'd seen the bones of these things and they figured they must still exist somewhere. They really didn't know. They really didn't know what they would find out there. So my idea when I started the novel was like, what if they found everything that they thought they were going to find out there? What would that be like? Well, it's changed a bit since then, but there's going to be some weird stuff in there, and including some time travel where the main character ends up hopping a wall that's a highway wall on an interstate highway. So I'm going to have a lot of fun with it. It's not going to be a realistic novel in any
way. No, clearly not your typical historical novel. Do you have a title for it yet?
Called Dear Mr. Jefferson.
Dear Mr. Jefferson.
And that is because the entire novel is written as a letter to Thomas Jefferson.
For the time being, at least, we can send people to Songs for the Deaf, published by Burrow Press, which you can get on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And the first novel, which is The Legend
of the Barefoot Mailman. That is not in print anymore. It was re-released not long after Songs for the Deaf as a 20th anniversary edition with a new foreword by one of the characters. So that is available as an ebook on Amazon.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And I'm sure people can find it, the physical book in their libraries across the country too. So something to look for. Well, I think we've run out of time, but I could talk to you for hours. Clearly, I enjoy myself enormously with this conversation.
This was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day. I know you're in the middle of getting things ready for the summer. You got lots of plans to take care of. So I'm going to let you go, but thank you again and keep up the good work. We'll be looking for your new stuff as it hits the shelves, which hopefully we won't have to wait too long for.
Thanks. And best wishes for a short story today.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
All right.
Bye, John.
I think there's a lot of valuable information for young writers who are listening to this podcast to take away from that interview. And now we'll move on to the short story for today, taken from the anthology Songs for the Deaf. It's called Wind and Rain, and it's narrated by the older brother of a young man who lies in the hospital in a coma. The two had been stopped on the road by a police officer who fired his gun at the younger brother as he was reaching into the glove compartment for his license. And in that moment, both of their lives are changed forever. So here it is. Wind and Rain by John Henry Fleming. First, let me tell you about the rain, Lewis. Last night it started to rain when I walked home from the hospital. I didn't even notice it for a while because it was thin and slow. Then the mist thickened and began to roll over me. A few drops ran down my cheek. By the time I came out of the liquor store, the rain was full and steady and the whole world looked shut down and closed up. When it rains like that, I think about the cop and what the cop said in his report. He said maybe it was the rain that made him believe he saw a gun in there. You remember what was in there? I do. When I went and claimed your car from the police, the first thing I did was search through the glove compartment. There was an owner's manual for the wrong model, for a Monte Carlo instead of a Grand Prix. There were a few notes from Lila. I read them, hope you don't mind. Baby, meet you here at 3. Love, Baby. None worth keeping. You probably just put them there to put them somewhere. There were a couple of paper clips in there, a broken pencil, a mileage log from the previous owner, gum, Tic Tacs, a plastic bag with cookie crumbs, your driver's license. How could he mistake any of that for a gun? Can the rain change things that way? Last night I sat on my bed and watched the rain. At the liquor store I'd gotten beer and Old Crow. I poured some of the Old Crow into my flask to take to work today. Then I took a big swig and felt it warm me. Mom doesn't like me drinking in the house, but she works cleaning offices now, doesn't get back until 2 a.m. I leaned back against the wall and looked at the rain. It was hard and steady, just the kind of rain the cop was looking through. I tried to test my eyes to see things the way that cop did. I looked across the street and I could see the big cracks in Mr. Cullen's driveway, the water streaming through those cracks and over the lumpy places where he tried to repair them. I could see the car under the carport and could tell it was a Dodge Diplomat, even though I couldn't make out the badge on the trunk. I could tell it was in pretty good shape for a car that old. I could see the striped awning over Cullen's living room window. There are 18 stripes and the water ran off each one. I could see through the living room, too, where the curtains weren't pulled together. Cullen was in his chair watching TV. I couldn't tell what show, but there was lots of action and quick scene changes. An adventure show, maybe, or a kung fu movie. Next to Cullen was a lamp on a table, and on the table was something I couldn't see so well. I thought maybe it was an ashtray. I stared at it for a minute and tried to imagine it was a gun. I squinted my eyes a little. I focused on different parts of it and tried to reshape it in my mind. It was no gun. Even if I could make it look like one, I knew Cullen would not have a gun there. And anyone who knows you knows that you would not keep a gun in your car. I don't ever imagine things in the rain. It's under the bright lights here that I sometimes have problems. Sometimes when I'm here, I think I see things that later I know I didn't. I think I see your fingers move. I think I see your eyes start to open or your lips start to say something. I'll see it out of the corner of my eye, and then I'll put down my magazine and move my face right up next to your plastic mask, and I'll try to see it again. And sometimes I think I do. Then I'm not sure. I remind myself that the doctors say there's no way. There's all that junk I put inside me, Lewis, the beer and the Old Crow. That kind of rain can cloud up your eyes from the inside. Maybe the cop really thought he saw something, and that's why he fired his gun. Later, when he got back to work after his suspension, he should have known he was wrong. But maybe he'd already stopped thinking about it. It was raining, and I saw everything clearly. I still do. And I think you do, too. Your eyes aren't open, but you're not dead, so you must see something. Do you still see the rain that night, streaking the windshield and dulling the glow of the streetlights? Maybe you're still looking into the glove compartment, watching your hand grab the license, your frozen picture coming into view. I hope that's all you see. I hope you don't see that cop out of the corner of your eye, raising the gun toward your head. I hope you don't see the flash. I told you once you ought to keep your real license in your wallet. What if a cop comes up on the street? But you said a cop can't ask you for your license if you're not in a car. You kept the fake license in your wallet just so you could go to bars with me, your big brother. And then you put the real license in your glove compartment. It's still there. I see it. I see the cop following us after we leave the bar. I'm looking over the seat and I'm seeing his lights right behind you. It's raining pretty hard and maybe you should be driving slower. But that cop shouldn't be on your tail like that. He's trying to scare you, Lewis. I see that now. I see the cop's headlights and I see his grill, the grill of a Caprice Classic. I see the big, wide hood, the wipers going. You know what else? I see his face, too.
Maybe there was a little light coming from his radio or something. But there it is.
His big wire rims. His pocked cheeks. I see him 20 years ago, too, a high school kid who doesn't fit in. Too much acne. Never got used to the way his own voice sounded after it changed. I see him reaching up to give a little siren blast. He likes the siren a lot better than his voice, though he's never gotten used to that, either. I see you walking back to him in the rain. He shines his spotlight on you. You lean over, trying to hear him in the rain, and your shirt clings to your skin. The water drips off your hair, your nose, your chin. You reach for your back pocket. Then you remember. "What's up?" I ask when you climb back in the car. "I forgot my damn license."
I told you. The cop has followed you back. He's shining his flashlight around inside. On your eyes, on me, on the back seat, then back to your eyes. You lose something? You ask him. That was a dumb thing to say, Lewis. I know you can see all right, but you aren't thinking clearly. The cop has on a hooded slicker. The rain is loud as it bounces off his hood. There are a few drops of rain on his glasses. Maybe those drops are right in front of his eyes. There are drops on the face of his flashlight, too, and maybe that changes the way things look to him. It's raining harder now. Everything is splashing and making noise. The street and the roof of the car and the cop's slicker and the cop's flashlight, like a machine grinding to a stop. In this kind of rain, most people sit in their houses and wait for it to end. They don't think anything that happens out in the rain can make any difference. They wait it out. Then they start their lives again. Maybe the cop thinks that, too. Nothing that happens now is going to count. When the rain stops and the water flows down into the street drains, anything that happens out here is going to flow with it. We know better.
The rain stays with us, and everything that happened in the rain happens again and again.
He said he saw something.
Can a license ever look like a gun? Even with rain on your glasses and on the face of your flashlight?
Let me see your license. You almost say something. Then I see your hand in front of my knees. The glove compartment is open. The flashlight beam is there. You feel around for just a second. You touch the notes from Lila. The owner's manual for the wrong model. The broken pencil. You feel your license. Then everything stops. The rain falls over the car and stops everything inside it. The hand touching the license, the gun rising and flashing, your head falling to my knee, my hand jerking up against the window, a dark streak on the window not washing away in the rain. I'm thinking, what is that? What is it? The same thought the cop might have asked himself a second earlier. You could have answered it for him, Lewis. All of these things are now one moment, and that moment is stuck inside the rain that falls in us both. Everything's clear in there. I wonder if the cop ever sees it too, or does the cop still see the gun that isn't there? Does he wonder what it's like to be you, Lewis, stuck inside one rainstorm and always living just that one moment, not remembering anything before or after, nothing ever changing? I know you know all this, Lewis. You don't need me to tell you what you see, but in all the times I've come here, I've never talked to you about it, not once. And when I looked out at the rain last night with the old crow warming inside me,
I thought maybe you'd like to know that I see it too.
Part of the time I'm out here seeing other things, but most of the time I've been in the rain with you, and I thought you might want to know that. The rain is why you're here, Lewis. It's why I've been coming here up till now, even when everyone else began to fall away into their own lives. They went back in their homes to wait it out. We stayed out in the rain. For you, it never stops. But I've been thinking about other things, too, and last night I started to put them together. I thought you'd want to know what I've been thinking. It's been so long since I said anything to you, Lewis. I didn't think it would change anything, but now I'm going to tell you everything I know. It's not much, but it's something. You already know about the rain. Now I'm going to tell you about the wind. A week after the shooting, I was back to work on the golf course. The superintendent said he was going to give me busy work for a while, stuff to take my mind off it. The irrigation man would fill in as his assistant. Any paperwork could wait. This went on for a few weeks, and I was beginning to think I'd lost my position. I didn't say anything, though.
One day I was out raking leaves. There was no wind that day, but there had been the night before.
And the wind had blown pine needles and avocado leaves all over the greens. I was working ahead of the greens mower, Enrique,
clearing the leaves off so he could mow the greens evenly.
3/16 of an inch all over. It was mid-afternoon, hot and still. I had to rake because the blower wasn't working. The sweat rolled down my neck and got soaked up by my work shirt. There were only a few golfers around. Quiet day. Only the sound of Enrique's mower one or two holes back, the sound of my rake. I'd been raking all day, not even stopping for lunch, so I could keep ahead of Enrique. I was doing the same kind of work I started doing there 6 years ago, and that was getting me worried. That irrigation guy was good friends with the superintendent. They both had agronomy degrees from Gainesville. Here I was doing the work of a high school kid. No offense, Lewis, but I'd already been through it. I didn't want to do it again. I'm older. I've got experience. My arms and back ached from the raking. I was thinking about my job. I was thinking about you. I didn't bring a flask to work then, but I'd had plenty the night before and plenty in the morning. It was still with me. My head wasn't right. It was quiet and hot, and then something came out of the clear sky and knocked me in the head. I remembered the sound of it like the crack of a baseball bat, and the echoes in my blood that made it seem for a second all my veins would explode at once. All I could hear was the crack, and it was everywhere, and then it was only in one small spot on my head. I rubbed the tears out of my eyes and saw I'd dropped the rake. I reached up and felt my head. It seemed to swell under my hand. It throbbed, and the blood warmed my fingertips. My eyes still closed, I heard an electric cart whir up beside me, right next to the collar of the green. Someone clicked on the brake lock. I blinked a few times and looked up. There were two old men there, and they were staring at me like I was something in the way of their golf game, something they had to check the rule book about, a divot that hadn't been repaired or a tree limb in the way of their backswing. Then the man stood up next to the cart and turned toward his friend behind the wheel. "You ought to thank him," he said. "His head kept your ball from slicing into the trees." They both laughed. That's when I first started to think about the wind. "Do you remember when I started work on the golf course? You were only a kid. You said, 'How do you play that game?' I tried to explain it then, but I didn't know all that much about it myself. Now I do. Here's how you play it, Lewis. First you go into the woods and yank out most of the trees. Then you bring in truckloads of grass from Kentucky or Bermuda or somewhere else, and you carpet over the space you cleared. Next you get your mowers out and you mow the grass again and again until it's so short you can't even call it grass anymore. You call it green because you can't tell it's anything else. Some of it you call fairway, which sounds a lot like freeway, which is what they ought to call it, because it's smooth and wide and the golfers drive up and down it in their little cars, weaving side to side like they own the road. Once you've got all the grass in and you've mowed it down to its color, then you build a few little mounds and you fill them in with sand. And they're like little deserts that get in your way, except you rake them real smooth so they're more like the beach in front of the Breakers Hotel. Once everything's been torn out and sodded and raked and mowed, then you finally get to knock a little white ball around until it falls into a cup. And if it takes you a long time to do it, it's nobody's fault but your own, because everything's been cleared out and mowed down for you. Everything's exact. Only the wind can change where your ball goes. If there's no wind, then you've got no excuse. If you hit the ball and it curves, it's only because you didn't hit it right. And if you hit the ball and it lands on somebody's head, it's because that's where you aimed it. This is what I decided was true with those two old golfers standing right in front of me, my head throbbing and blood on my fingertips. I thought, any excuse they've got has been cleared out and raked up and mowed away. The grass is exact and the fairways are wide open. The only thing left is the wind, and there was no wind. If there'd been wind and the guy had taken the same shot, the ball would have sailed over my head or maybe a little to the right, and I wouldn't have thought any more about it. The guy had taken a different shot and the wind had pushed it into my head. The guy would have that excuse. But there was no wind. The guy had aimed the shot exactly at my head, and once he'd struck the ball, there was nothing to make it change its course. It was all clear to me as I watched them smile at each other. The ball was sitting on the collar of the green between me and them. My head was bleeding. I took a step and picked up the ball, then walked over to the man who'd spoken, grabbed him by the back of his white hair, and jammed the ball through his teeth. When the ball fell to the grass, it was spotted with blood. The board of directors couldn't understand it. I hadn't even hit the man who'd swung the club. I'd hit his friend. I don't know why I hit his friend. Didn't seem to matter.
It still doesn't. The board called in the superintendent and asked him about it,
and the superintendent told me he couldn't answer them. He explained my situation to them. They said they understood, but that they couldn't keep an employee who endangers the golfers, especially ones who've done nothing wrong.
I said, so if I'd hit the other guy, I could have kept my job?
The superintendent shook his head.
Because I can still go hit him.
The superintendent just stared. When I walked out of there for the last time, I thought if there'd been a breeze, everything would be different. None of this would have happened. Bad things happen when there's no wind, Lewis. I know that now. You know something? There was no breeze that night in the rain. Can you see that? There's lots of rain, and I guess you can call it a storm, but there's no wind at all. I know that because I see how the rain comes straight down. It bounces off the top of the cop's slicker, off the top of his flashlight, off the top of his gun, exactly off the top. I left my job knowing something about the wind. I was going to learn more. I never told you any of this before. I never thought it would matter. Now I have to. I have to tell you everything. After I left the golf course, I looked around for a while, but I had to take something quick. This room you've got isn't cheap, and Mom doesn't make nearly enough cleaning offices.
I had to have something.
There was this man down at the city sanitation who remembered Dad. Dad was the first man he'd hired, he said. And somehow he'd heard about what happened to you. Newspapers, maybe.
He sent a note to Mom, and Mom told me about him. It was nice of him to remember, she said.
I didn't want to talk to him, but I had to, and he offered me a job loading garbage. I know you've done better, he said, but your father managed it for a long time, and he never complained. He was a good man, he said. I remember the first time I smelled Dad. You were just a baby, and I'd been blowing up balloons all day and throwing them into your playpen. I remember the taste and the smell of those balloons, like a hospital, clean and dry. By the time Dad came home, I was out of breath and a little dizzy. I could still smell the clean smell of the balloons until Dad crouched down next to me. Then I smelled him. I'd never smelled him before. I moved my face away and frowned. Dad didn't say anything, but he might have noticed because he left the room then to take a shower. I tried to make an animal out of the balloon he'd blown up for me. It popped in my hands, and I smelled him again. Once I noticed that smell, I couldn't forget it, even when I tried. Even when Dad took a shower, I smelled it. When I was almost old enough to start working myself, I thought, I never want to smell like that. I didn't mind the smells on the golf course, the grass, the machines, even the chemicals. All those things were better than the smell of someone else's garbage. I never asked you, Lewis, did you ever smell Dad that way? I smelled it on him even when he lay in this same hospital breathing through a tube like you. We both went to see him, and I wondered then if you smelled him too, but I couldn't ask. Now I wonder if you can smell me.
For the last few months I've taken a long hot shower before coming here,
hoping you wouldn't be able to smell the garbage on me. Now I've changed my mind. When I started loading garbage, I'd come home every day and stand in the shower for 20 minutes, soaping up and shampooing, trying to get the smell out. I checked myself after I'd dried off, smelling my arm and blowing into my cupped hands.
I smelled something, I wasn't sure.
Out on my route, too. After I dumped a can of garbage into the hopper, I put my nose right up to my arm and sniff. There, I'd think, that's me. I'm a garbage man. Everyone knows it, just like they knew it about Dad. If they forget, all they've got to do is get near me. They'll smell the rotten vegetables they threw out last night. I had a girlfriend for a little while. She moved in with us when I was between the two jobs. Her name was Melody, and she was sweet and understanding. I didn't deserve her. When I took the sanitation job, I couldn't tell her right away. It hurt too much. But she figured it out. From Mom, maybe. Maybe from the smell. One day I asked her how she liked the way I smell. I don't mind it, she said. Just smells like you've been chopping bell peppers. I had to kick her out. I couldn't stand that she smelled me. She might have smelled bell peppers all right, but someone else had chopped them. I hated myself, and I tried to make it worse. All day long at work, I'd hold my arm up to my nose and smell it. I'd smell my work shirt, too, and my trousers. Before I emptied the garbage into the hopper, I'd stick my nose into it and take a big whiff. It made me feel good to hate myself. Smell that, I said to myself. Nothing changes. It's the smell you're going to smell all your life. I started to bring a flask to work. I thought if I drank enough by afternoon, I'd forget to stick my nose in the garbage and I wouldn't hate myself so much. Sometimes it worked. Then one day I stopped in to see you on my way to work.
I'd never done that in the morning before.
That day I just sat there and looked at you from across the room for a minute, and that was it. I didn't say a word to you. But when I got to work, I still had that hospital smell with me, and it reminded me of those balloons I'd blown up as a kid. I didn't think much of it until I got out on my route. Then I took a big whiff of that first garbage pail, and this time it didn't smell like garbage. It smelled like rotten vegetables, sour milk, grass clippings, wet newspapers, shampoo bottles, diapers, even plastic bags and cardboard boxes, but not garbage. That one smell had become all those separate smells. I smelled every can I emptied that day, and none of them smelled like garbage. They smelled like whatever was put in there,
bell peppers or potato skins or splintered wood.
Every can had something different in it. Some cans had almost the same smells in them, but none were exactly the same. After that, I began to pay attention to all the individual smells. I stuck my nose in the garbage like before, only now it wasn't for self-pity. Now I wanted to pick out all the smells. I wanted to know what was in there by its smell. I got good at doing it, too. The other loaders saw me and started testing me.
They'd have me close my eyes and they'd put a piece of garbage up to my nose. Once they held up a dead gerbil, once a carton of rotten eggs. I didn't mind. Almost always I could tell what it was by the smell. I'd get worried when I couldn't. Sometimes there was no wind and I'd be smelling the same thing all day. That can dull your nose. It's all becoming one smell again, I'd think. Then the wind would pick up and I'd be okay. That's how I got good at smelling. I can smell just about anything. I can smell the difference between royal palms and coconut palms, between sea grapes and sea oats. I can smell what kind of animal is hiding in the bushes. I can smell a woman's perfume from half a mile away. When there's a breeze coming in off the ocean, I can smell what kind of fish are running offshore. Let me tell you, I can smell. And the important thing about smelling is to pay attention to the wind. Here's what I've found out, Lewis. The wind is talking to us all the time. Most people don't listen, though, because they don't know how to smell. But smelling is the only way to understand the wind. That's how it talks. The wind doesn't make its own smell. It carries the smells of everything else. It might take the smell of a pine tree's sap and carry it down the street to an old man sitting on the porch of a nursing home, looking out at traffic. Then that old man smells that pine sap and remembers when he was a kid and used to chase lizards and squirrels up those pine trees, and after when he'd hop down and look at his hands and they'd be covered with sap and little pieces of bark stuck to the sap, like he'd grown a new skin. He'd think,
Mama's going to be mad at me because that ain't never going to wash off.
But now he looks at his old trembling hands and he sees that it has washed off. He leans back in his chair and smells the sap, remembering what it felt like on his hands, remembering until the smell fades because the wind has taken it somewhere else. A boy might be walking home one night and he's mad at himself because he lost all his money shooting pool. He's had a few drinks, so he's looking at his feet to make sure they move the way he expects them to. And then he smells something, stops, and looks up. He sees that he's in front of his girlfriend's house. He has smelled what he smells when her mother opens the door for him. Her mother is house-dressed that smells a little like floor wax, all the little knick-knacks her mother collects that smell like they sat in the Salvation Army store for a year before she bought them, the paint on the mantel that's just beginning to chip. And from all the smells of the house, he finds the ones he knows belong only to his girlfriend. The cup of her palms, the inside of her forearms, the shoulder scar from her vaccination, the curls in her hair, and most of all, her breath. He reaches out for these smells especially, and he grabs onto them and holds them for as long as he can. Standing before her house, he smells all this, and he is happy. The wind has brought these smells to him. It is speaking to him. He is just drunk enough that he might go up and rap on her window. When these things happen, you might start to wonder if the wind is good or evil, but the wind doesn't care one way or another. It talks, and it wants us to listen. And the more we listen, the more it will talk. Not everything it tells us is good, but it's always something we ought to hear. The only time we should be scared is when the wind stops talking. When the wind is quiet, nothing changes. The sky stays the same. The earth stays the same. People stay the same. They smell the same. They smell just like their fathers.
When the wind is still, a man can swing a golf club and the ball will go exactly where it is aimed.
A man can raise a gun and his hand won't blow to one side or the other. He can fire the gun and the bullet will go exactly where the gun is pointed. Nothing will change its direction. The time between makes no difference. It doesn't count. Nothing will change what happens. When people want to hurt each other, they throw things at each other. Rocks, spears, golf balls, bullets. You take aim and then you let your rock fly, hoping your aim is exact and the rock will hit the other guy's forehead exactly between the eyes, knocking him out, making the blood roll down into his eyes so he can't get up and do the same to you. So the rock gets thrown and everything's looking good. But when things are in the air, they belong to the wind, and the wind doesn't work on calculations. The wind likes to blow things around, mess things up, throw off your calculations. It sees a tree full of leaves and decides the leaves are in its way, so it blows them all off the tree.
Then it sees somebody's piled up the leaves and it decides to mess up the pile.
It sees a quarterback put the football up and decides to blow it over to the defensive back. The wind can stop people from hurting each other, too. The wind might see the rock heading for the guy's forehead and decide to blow it off course. Then it just glances off the side of the guy's head. The guy gets mad and throws a rock back at you.
But that rock misses completely.
Because of the wind. You end up shaking hands with the guy, and you both say, "Forget it, we aren't good enough rock throwers to make it worth our time." But really, it's the wind. It's not that the wind is trying to teach anybody a lesson. The wind doesn't care about that. It doesn't care about anything. It just likes to push things around.
And that's a good thing for us.
If there weren't any wind, there'd be a lot more people hurting each other every day.
There'd be nothing to throw off their calculations. Golf balls would never miss. Bullets would never miss. These are the things I've learned about the wind. It changes the direction a bird flies. It changes the look of the sky by blowing the clouds around. It changes the look of the earth, too. Sometimes it carries leaves off of plants, and sometimes it carries their seeds and makes them grow somewhere else. And the wind changes people, too. It carries smells to them and makes them think about things. It talks to people that way. It reminds them that things can change, that things will always change. That's why I'm here, Lewis. Before I came in, I asked the doctor, can he smell anything? He didn't know who I was talking about at first. He'd forgotten about you. I reminded him, and I asked him again, can he smell anything? He said he wasn't sure. He said maybe. I said thank you. Then I came here to tell you all this. Maybe you haven't heard a word I've said. Maybe you can only hear the sound of the rain and the sound of the gun. But the doctor said maybe you can smell. And if you can smell, then the wind can talk to you, even if I can't. The wind changes things. The wind can stop the rain. It can blow it away. Then people will come out of their houses again and pick up where they left off. And you can smell the people and what's in their houses and the trees and plants around their houses and even the garbage they put out in front of their houses and the garbage men who come to pick it up. I'm going to try to show you what I mean. I'm going over to the window and I'm going to open it up. I never opened it before because I didn't think it would matter. I didn't think it could change anything. But there are trees out there, Lewis. Oak trees and pine trees. There are birds flying between the trees. Blue jays and sparrows. There are squirrels, too, and the squirrels are running in the grass. There are mushrooms in the grass, and blue and yellow wildflowers. There's a parking lot next to the grass, and there are cars pulling in and out of the parking lot. There are people walking to and from their cars, and those people have all sorts of smells. Their skin and their clothes and their sweat and their deodorant and shampoo and everything they've had for breakfast and lunch today. I'm going to open the window, and you're going to smell them all. The wind is going to bring them to you. Then maybe the rain is going to stop for both of us. Then maybe things will change.
I think that's a story that's going to stay with you for quite a while. Before we end the episode today, I wanted to give you that information about where to find the music of C.S. Fuqua and Matt Hawkins on Bandcamp.com. For Chris Fuqua, it's csfuqua.bandcamp.com. And for Matt Hawkins, this is a long one, Matt Hawkins singing some songs.bandcamp.com with no punctuation. I'm adding that information to the bottom of the homepage for the Short Story Today podcast, which is www.shortstorytoday.com. So that's it for the premiere episode of the all-new Short Story Today. Thank you for listening. Please join us next week when our guest will be Coralie Longmire, a fine young writer from Mississippi whose stories are sure to touch you deeply. Now we're going to let Matt Hawkins' song, Bridge of Stories, take us out. Thank you for listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I climb the universe on Christmas Day for you. I'd walk a long night looking for you, hoping for me, wondering if time will help you see me clearly across.